Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with composer Jennifer Higdon, the winner of this year's Pulitzer Prize for Music. Susan Lewis looks ahead to the Philadelphia Orchestra's upcoming tour of Asia. We speak with organizers of the first Philadelphia International Festival of the Arts, which takes place a year from now. And pianist Jeffrey Siegel tells us about performances in his Keyboard Conversations series, celebrating the 200th anniversary of the birth of Frédéric Chopin. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
On Monday, Philadelphia composer Jennifer Higdon picked up her Grammy Award statuette and also found out that she'd won the Pulitzer Prize for Music. Pulitzer Prizes began as awards for excellence in journalism, literature and education. In creating the awards in his 1904 will, publishing magnate Joseph Pulitzer gave the overseeing board the power to expand categories, and an award for music was created in 1943. The Pulitzer Prize for Music is awarded for, quote, a distinguished musical composition of significant dimension by an American that has had its first performance in the United States during the year. Higdon won for her violin concerto, which was premiered in February of last year by the Indianapolis Symphony with soloist Hilary Hahn, for whom the piece was written. It was recorded by Hahn and the Baltimore Symphony under Maren Alsop in June for release on the Deutsche Grammophon label later this year. In its citation, the Pulitzer Prize Committee described Higdon's violin concerto as a deeply engaging piece that combines flowing lyricism with dazzling virtuosity. With this award, Higdon joins a distinguished list of Pulitzer laureates that includes Charles Ives, Aaron Copland, Samuel Barber, Ned Roram, George Walker and John Adams. I met with Jennifer Higdon at her studio on Tuesday and first asked her about the conversations she'd had with violinist Hilary Hahn about the piece.
It actually was a conversation that went on for a couple of years because I thought, oh, it would be cool to write a concerto for her, and she said it would be cool to have one, but trying to get our schedules to coordinate and trying to get orchestras lined up, it took us a couple of years. So it was a conversation that evolved. It probably was over a five-year period from the start of the conversation to the premiere itself. And so it feels far enough back, I can't remember the very earliest conversations.
But. And in that time, she went from being pretty well-known to being stellar.
Huge, yeah, and winning Grammys herself, actually, you know, and doing pretty well, doing a lot of recordings. So
tell me what it means when a musician comes to you and says, for me. How for me is it?
It's definitely for them, although other people could do the work, but I kind of studied Hillary's playing. I have a lot of her recordings, but I also went to a lot of live performances, and I asked her, what do you want in the concertos or anything? Because if you're commissioning something, you can actually kind of tailor-make that. And the first thing she said was, I want a substantial work. I want something that's 30 minutes or more. The piece is about 33, 34 minutes, so it's a pretty sizable work. She said, anything goes, it's my job to learn to play it, so you can write anything you want, which that was pretty amazing. That's a pretty amazing statement to make to a composer because, of course, the composer's imagination goes berserk. You daydream a lot and you try to think of the hardest things you can come up with.
And you did on this. It's pretty difficult, isn't it?
It is. It's actually quite difficult. And Hilary makes it look like it takes no effort, but I know, in fact, it does take effort. It's fun to watch the audience, particularly in the cadenza in the first movement, because you can see everyone kind of holding their breath and leaning forward, like, is she going to be okay? Is she going to make it through this? But she always does.
We spoke shortly after it. I'm not sure. It didn't premiere in Baltimore, did it? No.
It premiered in Indianapolis in February of 2009. Oh. It was in Baltimore in, I believe it was June 2009.
And so. We spoke shortly after that. And even then, you were finessing the piece with her when you were in Baltimore. Tell me about those conversations.
Yeah, you know what? Most of the finessing was actually in the orchestra part. Hilary had her part down. I think there were a couple of spots. At one point, she wanted me to add an extra line. So she had a line going in her instrument, and she said, I wanted an additional line going along with that. I want to play both lines, which that's a pretty hard thing. So I sat down and wrote it for her, and I sent it to her, and I said, can you do this? And she said, in her typical Hilary way, yes, of course I can do it. So then for me, the only other adjustments were things in the orchestra, you know, where if something might be too loud or there's something needed to be brought out, I just kind of adjusted dynamics.
And it's done now. It's recorded now.
It is recorded. We just sent off the masters to DG in the past, I think, day. or so. But it's a pure coincidence of the timing that we've been working on the edits for a couple of months now. So it should be out in the fall for a worldwide release.
This has been a remarkable 24 hours. When I walked into your studio here, you were had just put your Grammy on the shelf, which you picked up today. You finished the edits on the recording of the violin concerto, and now this. You have a lot going on generally. This must be an exceptional 24 hours.
Yeah, it is an exceptional 24 hours. I have to admit, most people think when you win a Grammy that you get it immediately, but I had to go down to a Federal Express warehouse and pick it up. So it was a pretty cool thing to tell the receptionist there, oh, this is my Grammy. Her eyes about popped out of her head. So I have to admit, I've looked over at it quite a few times. I'm answering a lot of emails are coming in right now. So I keep looking over going, wow, is this my life? Is this really happening?
And what is the Pulitzer Prize? I know there's a cash prize involved, but is there a statue that goes with that or a certificate or what? Or do you know?
You know, I actually don't know. I don't know what goes with it.
Well, I know that there's a presentation lunch in May, so presumably they're going to give you something.
Oh, I'll have to check that schedule and make sure I'm there. That must be. There must be something there. It's kind of cool, though. I'm hearing from a lot of people. Ned Roram just called a couple of minutes ago.
Also a Pulitzer Prize winner. Yeah.
That's right. He said, this will change your life, and I believe him. You know, my biggest hope is that it just encourages people like to pick up the CD and find out. If they haven't heard my music before, just to check it out and see if there's something that they like. And luckily, I've got a lot of stuff coming out in discs right now. There's like all kinds of projects that are rolling along, coming out.
You were already incredibly busy as it was. Everything, every note you'd written was commissioned or was going somewhere. How can it change? I mean, you can't write any more than you write. You have one of the highest public profiles of probably any American composer at the moment. I'm just curious as to, have you even imagined about where it might go?
You know what? I haven't imagined, and you're right. My schedule is so full at the moment. I'm booked up to like 2015. I'm not sure. I don't know that there's any more than I can do than what I am doing. The only thing I could think would be the publishing would pick up, but right now that's actually moving at a pretty serious volume. We get about 5 orders a day, and that's a lot in classical music for one composer. But, you know, I always think there are all kinds of possibilities around the corner that I can't see, so I just try to remain open.
Composer Jennifer Higdon, winner of this year's Pulitzer Prize for Music. Her prize-winning violin concerto will be performed by the Curtis Symphony, a co-commissioner of the piece, with soloist Hilary Hahn in concerts in Philadelphia and New York City next year.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The Philadelphia Orchestra is used to taking its music on the road. Since its first transcontinental tour in 1936, the orchestra has visited continents and regions all over the world, places both familiar and exotic, including milestones such as 1955's tour of continental Europe, the Soviet Union in 1958, Central and South America in 66, Asia in 67, and mainland China in 1973. The orchestra also went to Israel in 1992 and Vietnam in 1999. Now, as the orchestra packs its bags again, WRTI's Susan Lewis considers its 2010 tour of Asia, with stops in Japan, Korea, and China, where the ensemble will perform at the opening festivities of the 2010 World Expo in Shanghai.
Taking a symphony orchestra on tour is not a family vacation, as difficult as that can seem. It involves moving over 100 musicians, staff, and related entourage, not to mention 30,000 pounds of delicate and valuable cargo from one city to the next, all geared to grand orchestral performances, one unique concert hall at a time. Philadelphia Orchestra tour manager Julie Kim says the most careful planning can never anticipate every problem.
We've had everything happen on tour, from people's passports going missing and being stuck in a country and flying them separately, to losing all of the orchestra's luggage, all kinds of mishaps. But in the end, it's all about how quickly we remedied the situations.
So in this high-tech age of nearly instantaneous transmission of high-quality sound, why tour?
Oh, that's very simple.
Philadelphia Orchestra chief conductor Charles Dutoit says although an orchestra can be heard on the internet and TV, on radio, on CDs,
there's nothing better than listening to an orchestra in a concert hall. This is valid for the city where you perform, but it's valid especially for countries outside, in Asia in this case, because there are many people who love the orchestra and love us to play together, and they want to see us in a live performance. Nothing can be compared to that.
A live performance away from home creates electricity for both concertgoers and musicians. Audiences are typically enthusiastic, sometimes wildly so, especially in Asia, says Philadelphia Chief Cultural Officer Gary Stoyer.
When they go to places like Asia, they're treated like rock stars.
Playing in Asia is always a joy because the audiences are really very receptive and kind of wanting our music.
So Principal Timpani, Don Liuzzi, says in an orchestra which is always bringing in new members, touring also creates a musical bonding experience.
It's just the act of playing out of town and out of your home situation kind of focuses the music making in a way unlike any other. And you're having to adjust to new acoustics every night, so that's always a heightening of the music making and a heightening of the listening that's going on.
While foreign audiences get to know the orchestra, Philadelphia officials like Mayor Michael Nutter hope they will also want to get to know the orchestra's home city.
These kinds of tours with international dimensions enhance relationships, I think pay long-term benefits. They elevate us to an international stage, and people around the world get to know the Philadelphia Orchestra, which, of course, causes many people to think, well, what else is going on in Philadelphia?
The orchestra tour is also an opportunity to promote the city as a site for conventions, which is why Philadelphia Convention and Visitors Bureau Vice President of Tourism Fritz Smith is going along.
So we're going to take the opportunity to invite tour operators, travel agents, travel writers, incentive and meeting planners, and government officials and invite them to some VIP receptions before the performances and then to see the show.
Yet the roots of this tour go way back beyond business opportunities to basic diplomacy. In 1973, at the special request of then-President Richard Nixon, Philadelphia became the first American orchestra to perform in the People's Republic of China. A relationship was born and grew through several more tours. It was on a 2008 visit to China that the idea of returning this year was conceived, says Craig Hamilton, the orchestra's vice president for community and government affairs.
And we thought, wouldn't it be terrific if we could plan an Asian tour around the expo? And so at that time, we started to speak with the folks at the Expo Bureau. We didn't know how it was going to happen. We didn't know when. And we didn't know who we'd be working with, but we knew we wanted to do it.
World Expos, or World's Fairs, with countries assembling to showcase their arts, culture, and industries, have been going on since the mid-1800s. Philadelphia hosted America's first World's Fair in 1876. They have been held in Dublin and Paris, Chicago, New York and San Francisco, London and Osaka. By definition, they involve global participation and a global audience. And opening the festivities for all will be the Philadelphia Orchestra. It is, says Orchestra President Allison Volgamore, a big deal.
The expo really will be a moment in time for our representing the United States. So 13,000 people, the only cultural icon in the first week of the expo. We actually will be ambassadors off the stage as well. And this really is important work.
The expo booking led to the creation of the three-week tour led by Charles Dutoit. 11 performances in 8 venues in 3 countries. The first 2 weeks in Korea and Japan, and then on to 4 performances in China. But touring is also about more than the concert experience. As they do at home, musicians also go out in the community, conducting master classes for university students and engaging people who have gotten nowhere near a conservatory. Don Liuzzi recalls playing in an orphanage in Vietnam.
It was an incredibly enriching thing. It requires a different skill than playing in the orchestra, and also you're really trying to connect with those kids. You don't speak their language, so you're just trying to connect with rhythms and melodies and whatever instrument you're playing and just speaking through that music.
On this tour, Liuzzi is among a small group organized by violinist Phil Cates, who will fly to areas hit by earthquakes 2 years ago to play in hospitals and shelters. And there are even a few non-musical activities, sightseeing, shopping, and baseball. The orchestra fields a team, scheduled to play teams drawn from orchestras in Japan. Touring, with its adrenaline rushes and jet lag, its combination of concerts and outreach, baseball and exotic food, logistical curveballs, and full houses of adoring fans, puts a human face on the sound of the Philadelphia Orchestra. Actually, over 100 faces, like those of bass horn player Jeffrey Kirschen, violinist Herb Light, and trombonist Blair Bollinger, all of whom are eager for this next adventure.
See what's different in Shanghai. The first time we went there, at least that I went there in 93, it was still like a German colonial kind of town there on the river and going down the coast, and now it's got the tallest skyscrapers in the world, so we'll see how much has changed.
In Seoul, a trip to Itaewon, which is the tailor shop of the Korea where they make custom suits, and it's an interesting place to visit. In fact, I still have a pair of shoes and slippers made of eelskin from there. I wear them on Friday afternoons.
I'm looking forward to playing in places I haven't played before. In Korea, the two cities there, and Miyazaki's a new place in Japan we haven't been to before.
The orchestra leaves on Monday. Its first performance is Thursday at the Sunsan Arts Hall in Changwon City, Korea.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. She'll be joining the orchestra for the final week of its tour in China. Listen here for her daily Notes from the Road reports beginning May 3rd. Jeffrey Siegel's Keyboard Conversations are concert plus commentary performances in which the world-renowned pianist speaks about, then plays, great piano works. These witty, informative presentations provide newcomers to classical music with an entry point for understanding the form, while seasoned listeners often gain a deeper insight and appreciation of familiar and sometimes less familiar works. Siegel has been hosting Keyboard Conversations for 40 years now. On Monday at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall, he presents the first of two keyboard conversations celebrating the 200th anniversary of the Franco-Polish composer Frédéric Chopin.
The program has compositions of Chopin that delight the ear, but also have certain musical elements in them that point the way to the future. And the program also has compositions of composers who were definitely inspired by Chopin, later composers. Tchaikovsky, who wrote an homage to Chopin, one of his last works. We have an Etude of Debussy, which is dedicated to the memory of Chopin. We have music of Alexander Scriabin, who was so obsessed with the music of Chopin in his youth that he actually slept with a volume of Chopin's music under his pillow for inspiration. We're going to have a mazurka of Szymanowski. We're going to have what may be the Philadelphia premiere of a work of a living American composer, Lowell Lieberman. We're going to hear a nocturne of his, very much inspired by Chopin. And we're going to have certain Chopin pieces that have elements in them that point the way. The beautiful E major Etude, Opus 10, number 3, for example. The finale of the Funeral March Sonata, which has no melody, no particular fixed harmonies, and the rhythm runs by to the point you can't tap your foot to anything. There's no noticeable downbeat. So it's a very stimulating, very interesting, but also very beautiful program.
How much knowledge, you're using terms like prelude, nocturne, etude, sonata. How much about these do we need to know to appreciate Chopin, or indeed to appreciate your presentation?
My feeling is you don't need to know any of these words, but I do, of course, explain what an etude is and what a nocturne is and so on. But I would be the first one to defend the fact that music does not need anybody to say anything about it. And not knowing what a nocturne is would not prohibit someone from being able to enjoy listening to it. But when you know that it means a night piece and that there are certain musical elements you can almost bet you're going to find in a nocturne, whether it's Chopin or Gabriel Fauré, another composer whose work we will hear on the program, or in the case of the American Lowell Lieberman, these nocturnes have certain things in common, even though it spreads a century and a half. So part of the Keyboard Conversations is to break down that wall that a listener may perceive as being between himself and the piece of music. And what I try to do with these programs is to break down that wall and also to make the listening experience more enriching than just a pleasant ear wash of sound.
Although he left Poland when he was 20 and went to live in Paris, he maintained a great patriotic spirit, and indeed the Polish people are extremely proud of Chopin. I heard this morning that a video games company in Poland is producing a Chopin video game at the moment in celebration of his 200th anniversary. There's a lot of Poland in his music.
Absolutely. And yet, the French have a legitimate claim to half of Chopin. His father was French, his mother was Polish. Chopin spent the first half of his life in Poland, but the second half of his life in France. So they really have a legitimate claim to half of him, and yet there was no question that he himself felt himself to be a very patriotic Polish person. And the fact that he was so attracted to the two nationalistic Polish dances, the Polonaise and the Mazurka, there's no question that he felt very, very strongly his Polish roots. In fact, the program which we will be opening next season with in October is called Chopin, the Passionate Patriot, and deals with Polonaises, Mazurkas, and we also slip in a couple of waltzes to show the French side of this composer.
You mentioned the classical composers that he's had an influence on, but his melodies have been influential all over the place since his death. Is melody his greatest gift?
I think he might have said that. Here is a composer who had this gift, Tchaikovsky had it too, of writing beautiful melodies that have a wonderful singable quality to them.
And a lot of the time they are the entry point for people finding classical music, Tchaikovsky, Mozart, Chopin, for that reason.
Yes, and I'm glad you mentioned Mozart also, this incredible ability to write these memorable melodies. The composer then goes on from there and writes the piece. And Chopin was actually criticized during his lifetime for not being an opera composer because he had this great ability to write these beautiful, memorable melodies. And many, particularly of his Polish friends, were constantly urging him to write the great, you know, Polish opera with this great melodic gift that Chopin had. But he was very, very true to what he believed to be his musical universe, which was the piano. It's interesting, Jim, in that here is unquestionably one of the greatest composers of all time, and yet there's not a symphony, there's not a string quartet, there's not an opera. With very few exceptions, his total creative output is for the solo piano. And yet the musical quality is so high, the beauty is so magnificent, that these are amongst the greatest works of musical art.
Pianist Jeffrey Siegel. Chopin and the Future, one of his keyboard conversations, is at the Kimmel Center's Perelman Theatre on Monday evening at 7:30. Chopin, the Passionate Patriot, is at the same venue in October. The Philadelphia Orchestra collaborates with Pennsylvania Ballet. Local hip-hop band The Roots team up for a performance with a French chanteuse. The Philadelphia School of Circus Arts performs in the Hamilton Roof Gardens at the Kimmel Center. Now, these aren't alternative entertainment listings. They're just a few of the 31 productions from next year's Philadelphia International Festival of the Arts, or PIFA. The festival will feature 111 different arts organizations, including the Philadelphia Museum of Art, the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia, and the Mural Arts Program, in venues across the city. With funding from the Annenberg Foundation, the festival aims to utilize nearly all facets of art, including music, dance, film, history, science, architecture, the fine arts, horticulture, and literature. Drawing its inspiration from the cultural mecca that was Paris in the early part of the 20th century, the 25-day festival hopes to produce one-of-a-kind performances and exhibitions through collaborations that might otherwise never happen. I spoke with PIFA's executive director, Ed Cambron, and artistic producer, Barbara Silverstein, about how next year's extravaganza is shaping up.
It's come together in the last year and a half in a way that is really, to some degree, surprising. The other thing that I think it's important to realize when you think about the festival is the collaborations that are happening are what make it also special, in that arts organizations in Philadelphia working with one another in new and innovative ways, and then working with artists who are coming in for the festival. So we're really, really excited.
111 different organizations, Barbara. He's very happy about that. I imagine for you it's a little like herding cats.
I don't know about herding cats so much, but it's been very stimulating, very exciting, sometimes very wearing, because this is a collaborative festival, and as a result, you end up having to visit with your collaborators many, many times and start brainstorming, and then you pick certain ideas, and you reject others, and you have to go back and start over again sometimes. So it can be kind of challenging at times, but I feel like I'm echoing Ed here, but it really is true to see where we've come. And one of the more exciting things about this process is to see how certain partners who maybe started out saying, well, I just don't see how we can make this work for us, and we would start talking, and then they'd try one idea out, and that wouldn't work so well, and we would try some others. And we just kept pushing and talking and massaging, and finally they would come up with the most exciting ideas. And it's just great to see how that's all coming together.
I can well imagine those conversations, because I imagine a lot of these organizations would say, we're really good at what we do. We're really good at chamber music or ballet or whatever it happens to be. Why do we have to hang out with those guys?
That's right. And sometimes, well, they wouldn't say that, but they might think that. But I think people sometimes, you know, have a comfort level, and so it takes a while for them to feel comfortable with maybe examining a way to change the way they work. And I think that happened in many cases. Other cases, some people were ready to just dive right in and say, yeah, we can do that. Great, we'll do it. So it was fun.
The overriding theme is Paris in the early part of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. Where did the concept come from? It's obviously a very artistically rich period in time.
It is incredibly rich period in time. It really grew out of early discussions about Stravinsky and the Ballet Russes in 100 years ago. And as we worked with the late Mrs. Annenberg and the Annenberg Foundation, the theme really grew to involve as many Philadelphia arts and cultural organizations as possible, something she believed strongly in, as well as encouraging organizations to work together collaboratively. And when that happened, the Stravinsky theme broadened. And if you look at the context of when Stravinsky was doing his work, that entire city was alive with immigrant artists who were challenging art forms. And that really became our inspiration behind the festival. It's about collaboration, innovation, creativity, all of which came out of what happened in Paris during that period, and something we want to create for Philadelphia, our version of that.
So final question to both of you. First to you, Barbara. What will success look like when the festival, the first year of the festival, ends on May 1st, 2011?
I think success will be seeing that the works that we hope we inspired through this entire process really made a difference to the audiences that heard them, but more importantly, that Philadelphia audiences and the regional audiences really embrace this festival as something that they feel really proud about, that it really says that Philadelphia is a major cultural center in the United States. And I think if people really come away from the festival feeling that, then we will have done a lot of the job that we wanted to do.
I would add to that, from my point of view, and Barbara's really been amazing at working with our partners, we're working on our future plans now in terms of how we move the festival forward and how that will look. We are very fortunate to have the support that allows us to do a major marketing effort on this festival and to really do something amazing. You know, if we leave that last night of the festival and the city of Philadelphia, its citizens have a little more pride in the arts and culture community than they did before April 7th, 2011, then I think we will have been successful.
Philadelphia International Festival of the Arts Executive Director Ed Cambron and Artistic Producer Barbara Silverstein. The festival runs from April 7th through May 1st next year. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ribchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under their music director, Rossin Milanoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan, our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.